It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone call shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. So what would you do if you were a doctor who wanted to save lives, and you could save a lot of lives, but the courts told you no? Well, the person behind that story is Tracy Beans, editor of Uncover DC. Although, Tracy, before we get to that story, do you mind if I ask you what your impressions are of both the crime itself that happened yesterday in Waukesha and the way the mainstream media is going to respond to it or not?
Oh, just so terrible. I mean, what a tragedy, right? I mean, you know, it was interesting to me that the FBI swooped right in to take control of this, and that they didn't release the name or image of the suspect for, you know, several hours after, as well as how that gentleman who was unaware he was live on air when he was giving his interview handled the fact that the perpetrator happened to be an African-American man.
Yeah, because I have a feeling they're going to lose interest in this very quickly, because you've got an African-American suspect. You have mostly white victims in this case, and they're going to say that one does not fit our meme. We're going to have to go somewhere else.
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, this is a tragedy, regardless of who was involved, what their
Agreed.
Political persuasions were. Yeah, it's terrible. And right before the holiday, it's absolutely horrible.
Well, and I just wonder whether people are going to start asking hard questions about this question of, should we allow people out with no cash bail? Well, here's the poster guy for that, and that is Mr. Brooks, who tried or is accused of trying to run down the mother of his child with an automobile, sending her to the hospital. He's in jail on that. And they say, how much bail should we ask? Oh, I don't know. He's a convicted felon. He's charged with possessing a gun as a convicted felon. He tried to run down the mother of his child with an automobile. How about $1,000? Make it easy for him to get out. And then he gets out, and he is now accused of 5 counts of murder after last night's incident, and that number may grow.
Defund the police, Lars.
Yes, of course. You know? Defund the police and let all the criminals out. Let me ask you about this. Are doctors being forced to let their patients die while they wait on the courts to let them do their job?
Unfortunately, yes. We've got a health system in Norfolk, Virginia, Sentara Norfolk Hospital, where Dr. Marek, who is the founder of the Frontline Critical Care Alliance, or one of them anyway, is using this protocol called the MAP Plus protocol that contains a number of different medications, all FDA approved, and he's using them off-label, like many doctors have chosen to do to save their patients from COVID. And the hospital came down and said, we're not allowing you to prescribe ivermectin anymore. You're not allowed to prescribe it. And he's watching his patients now die. He can't do what he's supposed to do as a doctor. His hospital system administrators are telling him, you're not allowed to prescribe this treatment to your patients for no reason whatsoever, other than they just decided to say so. Because the NIH guidelines don't even say that you shouldn't use it. They don't argue for or against the use of it. And he decided to take them to court because he can't, you know, he can't stand by the Hippocratic Oath and watch his patients die. He's lost 7 now in that time. He has rounds once a week. He's in charge of the ICU there at that hospital. He's a renowned physician all over the world, even before COVID. And they won't let him treat his patients. So he's suing the hospital. And now, while this happens, he's still not allowed to prescribe that medication to his patients. So, yes, people are dying, waiting for the court to make a decision.
And by the way, if you want racism, I mean, that gets thrown around a lot. But why is it that the world in general is ignoring what's going on in Africa with COVID? Because Africa's had a relatively small number, I mean, much lower, dramatically lower than a lot of the westernized countries. And Africa is a country that does not, you know, most of its population does not have ready access to the kind of medicine that's routine in Western Europe and the United States. And you say, why is that country doing so well with COVID? I mean, it's not COVID-free, but the numbers are dramatically lower. And then when you say to them, well, let's see, they use a lot of hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for malaria, which is endemic to that continent. And then they use a lot of ivermectin to cure river blindness. And in the countries that have had specific programs aimed at that, these two other treatments that people have said this works for COVID have been used for other purposes in that continent. And then you just coincidentally get a relatively low number of COVID cases. And the rest of the world walks by saying nothing to see here. Just ignore that stuff. Move on. Move on. And that doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it doesn't. At this point, there is literally zero reason not to allow doctors to use this medication. There are at least 64 double-blind placebo-controlled studies at this point proving the efficacy of both of ivermectin, and I know there have been several on hydroxychloroquine as well, and a number of other medications. Fluvoxamine is one. There are a couple of others on the protocol. They've all been studied. You know, initially the argument was we don't have time to do these year-long, two-year-long, three-year-long trials of medicine that's already been FDA approved, and in the case of ivermectin, has a better safety profile than Tylenol does. We just don't have the time to do that stuff. So let's just try this and see if it works. The method of action seems to be correct. Let's try it and see if it works. And it does. And the only reason that Dr. Corey, who's another founder of FLCCC, can come up with
we've had him
this
on.
Is happening is, well, he's fantastic. I love him to
yes,
death.
He is.
He says that it's that they want expensive, novel pharmaceutical drugs to take the place. Look at how the authorized treatment is remdesivir, thousands of dollars for a dose of remdesivir. It damages the liver and the kidneys, and it doesn't work. But yet this is just a bucket treatment that everybody that comes into the hospital with COVID and ends up in the ICU is getting. So there's a very big problem with medicine in this country right now. And these doctors who have been acclaimed and renowned far before COVID came along are being tarred, feathered, and told they cannot practice their craft, with the AMA Lars even coming out threatening to remove their medical licenses should they spread, quote, disinformation, Lars. Whoever the arbiter of that is in science, let me know. And it's terrible, and it needs to have awareness raised to it, and your show always lets me talk about this, so I appreciate
well,
it very much.
I'm glad to do it. Tracy, have you ever run into the name Dr. John Campbell, this guy from Scotland?
Yes.
Okay. I started, my wife and I, on the recommendation of a Democrat friend of mine, said, hey, you got to watch this guy. He's interesting. And he seems to know his stuff. And he always explains, I love knowing the mechanism of how something works. That is, they don't just say, take this pill, it'll cure what's ill, you know, your ills. You say, how does it work? And they say, well, duh. And he's really good at that. Within the last 2 or 3 weeks, we've tried to get him on. We'll line it up at some point. But he explained, he did one, and he was kind of, he's a real nice older gentleman, but he's done a lot of work in refugee camps and, you know, good works around the world. And he says he was a little bit snarky because he said, now, let's take a look at this new, the Pfizer COVID treatment for after you get it, not a vaccine. And he says, and what's the mechanism by which it works? And I learned more about protease inhibitors than I've ever seen in my life. But he explained it in a way that actually comes across to a layperson like me. And he says, now, let's look at ivermectin and how it works or how it's supposed to work. And he points out scientific studies. He puts all the links up. And he's not trying to sell anything. You got to read this story from Tracy Beans at Uncover DC. Tracy, thanks so very much. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, Joe Biden and the Democrats have been trying hard to sell this Build Back Better Act of theirs, and I hope, frankly, that it dies a horrible death in the United States Senate. But I thought we'd talk with Maxford Nelson, who's Director of Labor Policy at the Freedom Foundation, about one particular aspect of this thing. Maxford, welcome back to the program.
My pleasure, Lars. Thanks for having me.
So if a politician is trying to sell an idea, and they come out and they say, why, we're going to have huge numbers of jobs, but what Joe Biden and Jen Psaki, Peppermint Patty, keep saying is for union workers. I keep wondering, is anybody out there, are even the reporters covering this, are they ever inclined to say, well, hold on, private sector union workers, that's 6% of America. So this is great jobs for 6% of America and nothing for the other 94%? Is that the way this thing is engineered to work out?
Well, that's about the size of it, Lars. You know, but President Biden now, since his time on the campaign trail, has made it clear that he wanted to be the most pro-union president in American history. And that's different. That's very different, as you point out, from being the most pro-worker president in history, as the interests of union bosses are often out of alignment with those of the people they claim to represent. But in this case, you know, this is a massive piece of legislation, multi-trillion dollars. The official cost, you know, is nearly $2 trillion, but a variety of independent estimates are showing that the likely real cost of this legislation over 10 years will be, could be upwards of $5 billion.
$5 trillion. Sorry, we got the T's and the B's mixed up. And Max, I understand it. We're up in that stratosphere where the numbers just don't make any sense anymore.
That's exactly right. And, you know, what people need to realize is, you know, there are so many arguments, good arguments to be made against big government. It intrudes on our lives. It's inefficient. It crowds out entrepreneurship, and it depresses the economy with high taxes. All of that is true. But what people need to realize also is that it's a vehicle for political officials to steer money to their allies, to their friends and their cronies. And that is exactly what is going on with this piece of legislation and its expansion of Medicaid funds for home and community-based care for the elderly and the disabled.
Well, and one of the other things that popped up, and I think you're familiar with this one, but last week I was talking to a young lady who's an analyst, and she said, do you realize that for daycare, they're going to insist that daycare workers be paid the same as classroom teachers in an area? And I thought, hold on a second. I know that right now in most parts of America, a daycare worker, and pick whatever city you want, San Francisco, Seattle, or smaller cities, that there's a dramatic difference in the two of those. And I know that just on the face of it, if somebody said, we're going to pay daycare workers the same as teachers, I don't know how it's going to make the teachers feel, but I'll bet the daycare workers are like, yeah, that's great. We'll get these gigantic paychecks. The problem is, number one, for that gigantic paycheck, you're going to have to be qualified, and that may push a lot of people out of that business. And the second thing it's going to do, it's going to jack up the price for everybody who has to buy daycare because husband and wife both work. And I don't know if they realize if you say everybody's going to make a lot of money, great. How are you going to make that pencil out? Oh, I don't know. You know, we'll get it out of the taxpayers somehow. And then the unions will look at that group and say, well, we want to unionize that group if they're not already. Now they've unionized almost every classroom teacher in the government schools in America. Are they going to do the very same thing to all of the daycare workers, let's say? We're talking hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, which is going to be a boon to the unions and probably effectively a boon to the Democrats as well, because unions give almost all their political money to Democrat candidates.
That's exactly right, Lars, and that is going to apply in multiple different industries. The childcare dynamic, of course, is one that's very concerning. One that we've spent some time looking at the Freedom Foundation is the home care workforce. You know, people who are taking care of Medicaid-eligible, disabled, and elderly individuals at their homes and helping them just navigate the challenges of daily living. And this is a workforce that has been unionized in several states, 8 states to be exact so far, and it's already a major revenue source for unions. But this legislation provides conditions, federal funding, this additional federal Medicaid funding, on states structuring their home care programs for Medicaid clients in such a way as to incentivize unionization and to put in place a legal structure that would allow for these unions to require dues payment of these caregivers. And Lars, in most cases, these folks are relatives of the people that they're caring for. It's a parent, you know, taking care of a disabled adult child, for instance. They're working in oftentimes their own home because they live with the client. There's just not a traditional role for a union to play. There's no traditional workplace setting here. And so the unions collect this money directly from the Medicaid paychecks that go out to these caregivers. And you're absolutely right. Having very little to do in terms of their representational duties, they turn around and put that dues money to use in partisan political activity instead.
Well, and here's the other piece that I want you to help me with. And that is, I've actually heard from some of the workers who do home care, who ended up having, you know, they were unionized by force. They were just told, we got enough people to sign the card, check card, and even though you weren't one of them, you have to be in the union. And where they're caring, whether it's a family member or somebody they don't know, they've said to me, let's say a given person is allocated $500 benefit per week, you know, for their home care. And if that used to buy 10 hours or 20 hours of time, and they say, now we're going to unionize, we're going to jack up the compensation. And you say, but now the number of hours that that amount of money can buy is much smaller. So they have to go to their client and say, look, I'd love to help you out. I used to help you out, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 hours a week. Now I can only help you out 8 hours a week. I get paid a lot more and you get less service. So this, it doesn't just adversely affect the worker. It can adversely affect the client, the patient as well, can't it?
It absolutely can. And there's a host of examples as to why. Out here in Washington State, we have, I think, what SEIU and other labor unions would characterize as kind of the model for home care. It's all unionized. It's very expensive. There are strict and very regimented training requirements that are in place. SEIU has a sweetheart deal where it is the only provider that the state recognizes for this mandatory training that all these caregivers have to go through. But, you know, our state auditor has found that there's no evidence showing that the training improves client outcomes. You know, it amounts to barriers to entry. It makes it harder for these caregivers to actually provide care and get new caregivers into the industry. But it's a massive revenue generator for SEIU. So the solution from the union standpoint and from the big government progressive standpoint is let's just do everything all the time. You know, we want to jack up the pay, but we also don't want waiting lists. And so the solution is always more federal money, more federal spending, more diverting of, in this case, Medicaid dollars to our friends and cronies for them to benefit off this arrangement without providing anything of benefit to taxpayers or service recipients. And that's just not an economically or a fiscally sustainable model.
No, it certainly doesn't sound like it. Max Nelson is the Director of Labor Policy at the Freedom Foundation. Max, thanks very much. I appreciate the time.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. And if you want to jump on board, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers go to the head of the line. If you'd rather email, it's talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to take it to the minimum, just vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. It is supposed to be the job of law enforcement, you know, agencies like the FBI and perhaps the ATF to catch criminals. But can you imagine becoming a millionaire because of your interactions with law enforcement? Well, the guy who's got the numbers on that is Adam Andrzejewski, who's CEO and founder of Open the Books and a columnist at Forbes. Adam, welcome back to the program.
Great to be on the program, Lars. Thank you.
Let's start with the headline number. How much money have the FBI, the DEA, and the BATFE, it was much easier when they called it the ATF, how much money have they paid out to criminals or informants over the last few years?
Well, it's an excellent question, and here's what we were able to ballpark. Our auditors at OpenTheBooks.com tied out $500 million, $548 million that was paid in recent years to informants working for just three of the federal law enforcement agencies. And that's the FBI, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and the Bureau of Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives.
Now, here's the question I've got. I understand that throughout the years, cops will pay CIs, confidential informants. They have different terms for them. But they'll pay them some amounts of money to gain their cooperation. But how much money do they have to pay out? I mean, in other words, what's the I just asked the marketplace. If somebody said, gee, I've got a pickup truck for sale, I'd look up the year, I'd look up the make and the model and the condition it's in, and I'd say, well, that looks like the marketplace for that looks like $5,000. There's some way of telling it. How much money do you have to pay to somebody? And let's assume in this case they're not involved in the criminal activity themselves, because if they are, I would think you could get their cooperation by simply saying, we're not going to prosecute you as thoroughly as we would if you didn't cooperate. So these are people who are cooperating with law enforcement. How much do you have to pay them? How do you figure out the right number?
Well, that is the question. Now, our auditors at OpenTheBooks.com found at least two employees that are two federal informants. They're called human confidential sources, and that they made over $1 million apiece. One was a parcel employee, think UPS, FedEx. Another one worked for Amtrak. made over $1 million over a 6-year period being a confidential human source for the DEA. The inspector general actually screwed down on that one, did an investigation and found that it was an entire waste of $1 million. They found there was no substantial information benefit that they couldn't have received for free by partnering with the Amtrak police. So that is the question. The DEA, we found, on average, over a 6-year period, paid out $26,000 per informant.
Average. I guess what I'm thinking about is, if you are if you're somebody who's a law-abiding citizen and you work at a job, say you drive a parcel truck, I don't know what they make, but I'm guessing they probably make decent money, $60,000, $65,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year. If you were to offer to any one of those people, I tell you what, we'll pay you 10% of what you regularly make on top of the money. I assume these people still worked at their regular jobs because that's what gave them access to the information that made them valuable. Why would you be paying much more than that? If, say, over 6 years you pay somebody $1 million, if I've done the math right, you're paying them like $150,000 or $160,000 a year. That sounds like more money than they make at their regular job. How would they persuade these federal agencies, I'm worth that much? Unless they could really say, I'll help you uncover $50 million in fraud or $5 million in fraud.
Exactly. Well, you raise salient and good points, Lars. And here's the deal. You know, by design, federal informants for law enforcement, it's a black box. We're not really able to see into it very much. But our auditors, from government audit reports, from congressional testimony, from Freedom of Information Act requests, we were able to tie out the sheer amount of the complex. And it's actually pretty stunning. There's tens of thousands of federal informants every single year on the payroll, and they're getting millions of dollars. For example, the FBI, $42 million on average for a 7-year period. Each of 7 years, $42 million was paid out through the Federal Bureau through the FBI. So, look, there's a lot of people on the payroll. They're making a lot of money, and it's our tax dollars. And so at OpenTheBooks.com, published at Forbes, we're able to shed some light and shine a white-hot spotlight for the first time on this complex.
Well, and I would expect that the agency, if the agency said, look, we can show you, we spent $10 million last year, and we found $100 million worth of fraud. Or $100 million worth of thefts, they might say, well, that's not too bad. 10% is what you pay to not only prevent or detect theft of one kind or another, fraud or just overt theft, that if you said we've recovered at a 10-to-1 rate, that you'd think the agency would be happy to say, we can make the case it was worth $10 million because this is the amount of harm that we avoided for the people we serve, the public. Can they do that?
So we see no evidence of metrics being applied. What we obviously, federal informants for law enforcement, there is a gainful public purpose to it. But we do think it needs oversight. We do think it needs some after action transparency. And that's what we've tried to do in our piece. We also found that in addition to crime, there's corruption within the system. And anytime you have a black box without transparency, you're going to get corruption. So Jason Chaffetz in 2017, when he was the representative from Utah and head of the U.S. House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, on the floor in Congress, he delineated a case that he found where nearly $250,000 was paid out to a female informant. She had testified in a court case. She had no idea how she earned the money. Later on in the same court case, it came out that she had a sexual relationship with her DEA supervisor.
I was going to guess.
So there is corruption in the system.
Yeah, and you would think, I mean, when the boss says, how much have you paid out to this young lady? And the agent says, well, we're giving her, you know, $10,000 a month or $10,000 a quarter. I would think that at some point the boss would say, and what are we getting for that money? And if the agent can't explain it, then I would expect that the number one, the money would get cut off. And number two, the agent might actually have to do some more explaining. And if he can't do the explaining, then maybe he's looking for a new job. You can find all this at Open the Books. And of course, you can read the columns written by Adam F. Angievsky, because he is a writer for Forbes magazine or Forbes.com. Adam, thanks so very much. I appreciate the time. Now, if you want to sound off, It's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can stream the show, you can podcast the show, and you can always tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show. If you're still buying name brand CBD, you're probably paying too much. Now you can get generic CBD for about half as much money. On a jar of salve, you might save as much as $50 right there. Generic CBD is not available in stores. You go online to genericcbd.com, your number one source for generic CBD. And every generic CBD product is third-party tested for quality and strength. You know you're getting exactly what you paid for. And generic CBD is grown on American farms. It's made in the USA. It contains 0% THC. Plus, shipping costs right to your front door, that's free. You won't find a higher quality CBD product anywhere at any price. So why not give generic CBD a try? If you don't agree it's as good or better than your current brand, you get your money back. It's that good. Go check them out at genericcbd.com. These products and statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease or illness. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I mentioned we saw lots of videos from an event in Waukesha where there were small children that by just a foot or two missed being killed by what has happened. The man who's charged or is expected to be charged is Daryl Brooks. And I thought I'd talk about some of the implications of the bad decision-making in Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, with Lance LaRusso, who's an attorney, a former cop, and the author of the books When Cops Kill and Blue News, the proceeds of which go to police charities. Lance, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we make of the fact that the DA there, having allowed Mr. Brooks, who at this point is, even after he's charged, when the charges have been brought, he has a right to his day in court just like anybody else, but he is now admitting already the bail was far too low and that it was a bad decision. And yet he's also a DA who has for some time now advocated for either no cash bail or dramatically lower bails, and only apparently changed his mind when a low bail suspect is identified in a horrendous crime like this one.
This should not surprise anyone. This is a trend that's been going on for years. The past couple of years in particular, it's been accelerating. But this notion that when somebody commits a violent crime, they should not spend any time in jail and they should be given extremely low bonds. He was given a $1,000 bond, and one of the charges was obstruction of an officer along with other crimes. People distinguish themselves by committing crimes. When they are dangerous crimes, they should be removed from society for a period of time until the court system can at least arraign them and find out exactly what's going on and why this person committed the crime, what their propensity is for violence. That's done to protect the public. And unfortunately, those concepts have been hijacked by people who are trying to either make a name for themselves or think they know more about dealing with criminals than law enforcement. And clearly they're wrong.
Well, Lance, I'm not an attorney like you are, but I've been around it because I've covered a lot of court trials. And I know that technically the courts have said the only proper purpose of bail is to make sure that somebody shows up in court and answers the charges when they're supposed to show up. So to a large extent, bail is limited. You can't just say this is a bad guy. We think he's done a lot of bad things, and we want to lock him up pending his trial. If he's likely to show up at court, then you're not allowed to just effectively imprison him by setting the bail too high. But in the case of Mr. Brooks, this is a guy who's already a convicted felon. Then he gets tagged with charges of a felon in possession of a firearm, bail jumping, among other things. And then the most recent incident for which he was out, which he got out on that $1,000 bond, was that he is accused of running over the mother of his child with an automobile and sending her to the hospital. Is a judge allowed to look at that whole totality of the facts, like cops might want to say, totality of facts and say, you are a bad actor, and if I let you out, you're going to go out and get involved in other criminal and dangerous activity or not?
Well, you're absolutely right. The reason for bail is to, number one, secure someone's attendance at trial, but second, also to allow them to have an opportunity to prepare a meaningful defense and assist their attorneys in the preparation of that defense. But courts for years have looked at, and they are authorized to look at, the totality of the circumstances regarding the person's criminal history, regarding all sorts of other factors, whether they are a danger to people in society, whether or not they have presented a danger or pose a danger to witnesses in the case, and whether or not there is a propensity that they will either leave the jurisdiction or reoffend and place individuals at harm's way. And part of what you see happening, it used to be that when somebody committed an obstruction of an officer or the possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, there was a recognition that that person poses a danger and therefore their bail should be higher. But
right.
What we've seen it in New York and other jurisdictions where they're trying to remove the stigma, if you will, of jail, and people are coming out reoffending. And in this case, this man was allowed to drive his vehicle. He'd used a vehicle before to commit acts of violence, according to the news. And he, in this particular case, we don't really have an explanation of why. If this is the man who did it, there's five people dead because he was let out of prison.
Well, and let me ask you about this. I mean, while Democrats are allowed to exhibit double standards, because without that, they wouldn't have any standards at all. We've got the most recent double standard of Kyle Rittenhouse, who was accused of shooting three people, killing two of them, but did so in self-defense and made a fairly good self-defense argument. They charged him anyway. I never thought he should have been charged with a crime. I think that and in the same way that George Zimmerman shouldn't have been charged with a crime, but he was. And then they demanded a $2 million bail as though this 17-year-old was going to flee the country to a non-extradition state somewhere and not show up to answer the charges at trial. $2 million for him and $1,000 for Mr. Brooks? That's a double standard in the same state, right?
Well, and what's interesting about it, the judges are supposed to set particularized bail. Now, some charges have standards, minimum bails. Some also have conditions of bail, such as if you're charged with murder, you're not given a bail until a first appearance or until you have an opportunity to appear in front of a judge.
That is Lance LaRusso, the author of When Cops Kill and Blue News. And as I said, when those books sell, the money doesn't go to Lance. It goes to a charity that is designed to help out the families of men and women who've given their lives in the line of duty as police officers in their community. If you'd like to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every night at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show. It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I have to admit, if I have a dog in the fight, I have a dog in the fight because I very much like President Trump. I thought he did great things for this country, and the people who worked for him and with him, especially his top advisors, I have great admiration for. And I say that in aid of introducing Jason Miller, former spokesman for the Trump campaign, and now the CEO of a brand new social media platform. And yeah, Jason, I always try to, you know, prepare my audience by saying, look, I've got no financial ties to Getter. I hope Getter becomes the replacement for Twitter and Facebook and all the other social media out there that are run by left-wing billionaires who want to censor the American public. You've promised never to do that with Getter, spelled G-E-T-T-R. Welcome to the program.
Lars, good to be back on with you, and thanks for your continual voice of freedom, especially with the pretty chaotic times that we're seeing right now with this lack of leadership in the White House.
No doubt. So tell me this, Jason, why is there a need to produce something like Getter? I mean, I'm glad to see you headed up, but why have we run into a situation where folks like, you know, the folks at Facebook, the folks at Twitter and other places say, oh, we're going to be a platform? And then all of a sudden they realize we have the power to filter the information that the American public gets, and they run away with that kind of authority, and they decide to abuse it, not in aid of the American people, but in aid of their own political beliefs.
Well, exactly. I think what's happened is the Silicon Valley tech billionaires have become the woke masters general and decided to go far beyond maybe any initial goal they had with their platforms, trying to bring free speech or trying to be the social network and connect people together. And what we've seen over this last year is what I wrote in the Washington Times 2 weeks ago, the single worst year for censorship in American history, not just from the origins of COVID-19, when people were being shadow banned or being deplatformed for daring to say the virus came from a lab in Wuhan, or people being shushed if they dare to criticize Anthony Fauci, or even the silencing of the Hunter Biden laptop drama, which, by the way, I think if that story fully gets out and isn't suppressed by everyone from Twitter and Facebook and the mainstream media, then I think President Trump probably wins the race, and we're not dealing with this crisis in Afghanistan and everywhere else. And President Trump gets deplatformed. But then, Lars, kind of the cherry on top is that we now have a White House that is actively working with social media companies to pick winners and losers and play political discrimination when it comes to who gets free speech and who doesn't. And I think this is something fundamentally really wrong going on in our country. It's part of the reason why I helped launch Getter.
Well, and in fact, I'm talking to Jason Miller, who's the CEO of Getter. He used to work for the Trump campaign, and Getter is G-E-T-T-R, and I've got no other ties other than that we have an account on Getter. It's Lars Larson. But Jason, it's become so ugly that we've even seen the mother of a Marine killed in Afghanistan banned from social media because she said harsh things about the president of the United States. This is not where social media was supposed to go, is it?
No, and it's a even bigger problem than just social media. From the aspect, we saw General Flynn get a letter from Chase saying that his credit cards would be deactivated by September 12th. And quite frankly, we've also seen, not just here in the U.S., but we've seen the issues of cancel culture and censorship popping up all around the world, whether it's our friends in the U.K. Dealing with a pretty oppressive government on their handling of COVID-19. We're seeing a lot of election issues come up in Brazil with President Bolsonaro right now. Obviously, Modi has had his challenges with social media. Nigeria actually just kicked out Twitter completely. And so I think it's part of the reason why Getter, half of our user base is in the U.S. We have about a million folks in the U.S. and a little over a million outside the U.S. because this is a global problem.
Well, and is this the solution to it? I want to get your view on Section 230, because I've explained to my audience 230 at its essence says if you promise to be a platform, in other words, no censorship, then you get some protections that publishers like newspapers and even talk shows do not get. I can be sued for what I allow to go on the air, and that's even if it's a caller or a guest. Social media, for the most part, cannot because of Section 230. Do the social media platforms, including Getter and including Facebook and Twitter, deserve that kind of protection if they're not going to behave the way they promise to behave and just be a platform agnostic toward whatever is being said on their platform?
Well, and that's the part that you put on there if they behave. And again, that's what these platforms, including ours, are supposed to avoid, is making sure that we don't have political discrimination being part of the moderation process. Now, any reasonable platform, I think, will have some community standards. Nobody wants to have a platform with the Kathy Griffin photos of beheadings or the Hunter Biden photos of, well, youngsters in the photos that shouldn't be in certain photos that Hunter had on his laptop.
Agree.
Also, the same thing, you know, obviously, we don't want religious or racial epithets that people are, but that has nothing to do with political free speech, which is what we're aiming for. We have said that we will never censor, shadow ban, deplatform anybody for speaking their political beliefs, and we're holding to that. What the big tech companies, the big tech social media oligarchs are doing right now, though, is they're exercising political discrimination. So they're using their editorial judgment, i.e., we don't like anybody on the right, especially someone who's a supporter of President Trump's. We are going to hold them to a different standard. All we want is make sure everybody is treated the same and political voices don't get silenced.
Well, and why? I guess I've worked in media for 46 years, Jason. I wondered when in the fall of 2019, we started hearing about the Hunter Biden story and the laptop and stuff that we now have seen pretty well established. It's in the hands of the FBI. And we thought, why didn't this become a bigger story? Well, it was because it was banned by social media. And there were many Democrats who voted in the 2020 election who said, I wasn't even aware of that story. And if I had been, a certain percentage of them said, I wouldn't have voted for Biden. And yet that got silenced very, very effectively. And when I used to work as a reporter, I would routinely see news organizations go out and go to bat for other journalism issues because they realized that if we don't fix it when they're attacking somebody else, at some point they're going to attack us. And yet the mainstream media, for the most part, was quiet when that censorship went on of the Biden story.
Right. because, again, if it was the other way around, if, say, if you had the Trump administration working with news outlets or big tech to say don't cover a story, they'd be screaming bloody murder. And the people who control the media, people control big tech, are always going to go and coddle Joe Biden and the Democrats. You know, Lars, earlier in my career, I used to think the Democrats really ran everything. But now that I've gotten older and hopefully a little bit smarter, I really realize it's really big tech that really controls everything. They tell the media what to do. They tell the Democrats what to do. Democrats are just kind of the hapless vessels in this. But it really is big tech trying to create society as they want it to be. But you know what? That's why we have a platform that supports free speech and opposes cancel culture. And we're not going anywhere. In fact, Lars, one thing I'll tell you, we found today that Twitter is actually buying ads against Getter's name in the App Store. So if you go to the App Store and type in Getter, Twitter from a sponsored ad will be the first thing that pops up.
They're worried about it
than they have a right to be.
Unbelievable. They used to call them useful idiots back when the Soviet Union was around. Jason Miller is the CEO of Getter. We're on Getter, G-E-T-T-R, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. Before I get to our science guy, I don't know what Dr. G would respond to this, but in the state of California, ketchup is now more of a controlled substance than heroin is. In Los Angeles, they have a requirement. You don't get a package of ketchup at a restaurant unless you ask for one. This is their little bit to save the climate, they say. But in San Francisco, they're not only going to, you know, allow you to shoot heroin, they're actually going to set up safe injection sites where you can do it under the supervision and at the expense of non-heroin injecting taxpayers. So ketchup in the state of California will be a more controlled substance than heroin is. Now, I wanted to talk about satellites with Dr. Michael Gillen, who is our science guy, the physicist, astronomer, and mathematician, and three-time Emmy Award-winning former news science editor for ABC, the author of the new book, Believing is Seeing. Dr. G, welcome back.
Happy Friday, Lars. It's awfully good to be with you, my brother. Thank you.
It's good to have you here as well. Now, I think I'm going to mention to you, when I saw that the Chinese were lofting a satellite, Russia had lofted a satellite, and they said, oh, it's to clean up space junk. I said, I have a feeling that the space junk they're really talking about is the ability to destroy American satellites that might have strategic value, but they'll pretend that it's just a space de-junking satellite. Well, they went up and they destroyed a satellite that was orbiting just above the space station, the International Space Station.
Yeah.
And a lot of the astronauts raised a fuss, and I think they were right to do it. They said, if one of those pieces of junk, when it comes around the Earth about every 90 minutes, happens to punch through one of our astronauts or the space station, we've got a major problem. Are they raising too much of a fuss, or am I right that they're right to be angry at this?
No, they are absolutely right to be angry at this. This happened in the wee hours of Tuesday morning of this week. The Russians sent up a rocket that demolished one of their old defunct satellites. It's so concerning on so many different levels, Lars. But you have to consider this. It produced that single demolition. It produced something like 1,500 pieces of space junk that we can track, and something like 100,000 that we can't track. And you have to understand that there is already something like 10,000 tons of space junk orbiting the Earth. I mean, it is literally an orbiting junkyard with something like 25,000 pieces that are softball size or bigger. Can you imagine? But listen to this. All it takes is a fleck, just a tiny fleck, traveling at about 17,000 miles per hour. That's orbital speed.
Yep.
If it hits you, you're dead. I mean, you're toast. And I remember years ago being allowed to step inside one of the spaceships. I think it was the shuttle, but the space station is made of pretty much the same stuff. Let me tell you something. These things are like tin cans. They are not like armored vehicles up there. They have to be very lightweight because otherwise you can't get them into space. So these astronauts living up there in the International Space Station that were put in harm's way because of this demolition by the Russians are absolutely right to be outraged. They had to withdraw to their quarters. There's a Soyuz and there's a Dragon capsule up there So they had to vacate the International Space Station, vamoose into the capsules, get ready to disengage and come back to Earth. Fortunately, nothing happened. But I tell you, look, there's a bigger issue here, Lars. I remember when I was much younger, it would have been like in the early 80s, like in 1983, you probably remember this. President Reagan was in office, and he asked to start something called SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative.
Remember that? Yep. They made fun of it and called it Star Wars, and it turned out to be very prescient.
Exactly my words. I remember because I was there. I was in academia. I was still at Cornell. I was about ready to head up to Harvard. And I remember how even the scientific community, my own brethren, I'm sorry to say, made fun of it. They said, oh, you know, he's just dreaming. This is like space, you know, science fiction stuff. Well, if we had followed through back then, we would be in much better shape because what's alarming about this is not just that the Russians demolished a satellite. It's that what's going on with China. And by the way, we've done the same thing. So let's not just point fingers at Russia. We've demolished a satellite in space. The Indians have, the Chinese have. What is this telling us, Lars? It's saying that our conflicts are moving into space. So they laughed at Reagan. They laughed at Trump when he proposed the Space Force. Well, I don't think we should be laughing. I think we should be taking this very, very seriously because clearly the Russians and the Chinese especially are preparing for warfare in space. And if we laugh at that, they are going to get the last laugh. I'm sorry. This has got nothing to do with politics, and this has everything to do with wisdom. So to me, that's the biggest alarm of all.
Well, and in fact, Doc, I mean, I remember reading, because I've been a space fan since I was a little kid, and my parents had a friend who worked at, I think it was TRW, and did some work on the Apollo system back in the day. And I remember reading that the walls on the lunar lander were so fragile and so thin, they said an astronaut, if he decided to, you know, give a kick to the side of the thing, could literally kick through it. And I think it was that thin. Why? Because of weight and other considerations. It wasn't exactly that thin, but they said the astronauts had to be careful because it was literally kind of a fragile vehicle in some ways.
Oh, no, absolutely. Like I said, I've been inside of one of these things, and I was astonished because I'm thinking, man, there's that thin wall of metal. And I don't care if it's a very strong alloy. There's a very thin wall between you and instant death. Remember, these guys and gals up there orbiting the Earth, okay, are orbiting in a near vacuum. And never mind the temperatures out there are very, very cold, but just the sheer vacuum. All it takes is one little piece of space junk the size of a paint fleck. If it hits you at 17,000 miles per hour, that's worse than a bullet hitting you. And once that thing is punctured, it's like recently we were driving down about 50 miles an hour and a rock hit our windshield.
Yep.
Well, it didn't just make a hole. It shattered the entire windshield. And that's what would happen to the wall of the International Space Station. Look, I'm telling you that the biggest issue, though, and we have to really wake up. Wake up and smell the coffee. There, we are moving all our conflicts spaceward. And I find that so ironic when we hear all these romantic visions about, oh, let's colonize the moon and let's go to Mars and let's get a fresh start as if, you know, somehow we're going to become angels in space. No, there's already evidence we're taking all our failings, all our fallen nature into space. And that, to me, is what's really sad.
I agree with you. Is there any way to snowplow the most popular orbits up there? I mean, you know, have something that would somehow take all these little bits of space junk and get them to burn up in the atmosphere, you know, kick them out of orbit. Any practical way to do that on any large scale on the most popular orbits where we have a lot of stuff up there?
You know, that's a great idea, but there aren't any things on the drawing board that I know of. There is something called a Whipple shield. It's named after Fred Whipple, who was at Harvard for many years, a very famous astronomer.
Yeah.
And the Whipple and the International Space Station has like 100 layers, 100 Whipple shields. And basically, they're designed to do exactly what you're imagining. They're like snowplows. But no, nothing on the horizon.
I got to tell you, you scientists and your funny names, I love it. Dr. Michael Gillen is with us. Dr. G, thank you very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to take your calls, and we'll get back to those calls shortly. But I have, over the years, talked to this man so many times. He was the 50th Speaker of the House of Representatives. He is the happy warrior who I'm sure wakes up on the sunny side of life every day. He gets out there, and it doesn't matter how many disappointments he might face. And that's how you actually produce the kind of results that were produced by an exceptional Congress back in the 1990s. And while he's written about the culture war that we're in the middle of right now in Beyond Biden, Rebuilding the America We Love, I'm reasonably sure that he's enough of a Southern gentleman that the now familiar phrase FJB has probably never passed his lips. But he might confess to having said, "Let's go, Brandon," a time or two. He is House Speaker Newt Gingrich, and it's a pleasure to have you back, Newt.
Listen, I'm perfectly happy to say, "Let's go, Brandon." Although I saw the funniest picture today of Biden's wife saying, "Please quit saying that. He now thinks his name is Brandon."
Okay.
So just goes to show you.
It's become omnipresent now. So when you write Beyond Biden, how do we stop the kind of destruction that's going on right now and what you've framed up as a culture war that's going on in this country, where we recognize that there are people out there who want to, as Joe Biden has said, fundamentally change America? How about those of us who don't think we want changed?
Look, I think you have to fight them. I think you fight them in the election, such as is happening in, you know, Virginia and New Jersey and elsewhere today. I think you fight them on talk radio and in the newspapers. I think you fight them at school board meetings, and if the school board's not responsive, you go back to elections and defeat them. One of the reasons I did not write an anti-Biden book is I think they're going to be so bad that I think they're going to be their own story, somewhere between the price of gasoline, the price of food, the price of heating this winter, the disaster on the border, the disaster in Afghanistan. Falling asleep at an international conference. I mean, they will do another, you know, and then worse than Biden is Kamala Harris, who is the one person who makes me grateful that Joe Biden is in the White House. You look at all that stuff and you know they're faced with a catastrophe next year. I think they'll lose probably between 40 and 70 seats in the House, and they'll probably lose about 4 seats in the Senate. And then I think they're faced with an even bigger catastrophe in 2024, because I think by then, you know, there's a simple problem with big government socialism. It just doesn't work. And that's, I think, probably ought to be the number one battle cry. But once you've said that, then you say, all right, let's say we do win. What do we have to do to compete with China successfully? What do we have to do to reform our education so kids are learning? You go down the whole list and you realize we have a ton of work to do that's more than just being anti-Biden or anti-Pelosi or anti-Schumer. As you know, I've been a good partisan. I'm pretty happy being against those people, but it isn't what the country needs in the long run.
No, you need to be in favor of something, but unfortunately, being in favor of things, I'm in favor of America continuing to have a lower tax rate than our foreign competitors to make this a good place to run a business and make things and employ people. And it seems everybody on the left is in favor of taking away all the great things about this country and giving all of our opponents on the globe, the friendly ones and the unfriendly ones, an advantage.
Sure, which is why the answer is to defeat them. I mean, if you're faced with people who are basically deranged, you're probably not going to convert very many of them. I mean, over time, they may get converted. We used to say in the 70s that a conservative was a liberal who'd been mugged.
Yeah.
So it may be as they fill up their gas tank or as they look at the humiliation on the border, et cetera, that or the morning that the federal government moves, 600 illegal immigrants into their neighborhood. There may be a morning when even liberals start to decide this ain't working, but I think our job for the moment is, we did a survey in a project we have called the American Majority Project, And when asked to choose between free market capitalism and big government socialism, it was 59-16 in favor of free market capitalism, which means that you had the people who are in power in Washington right now have 1 out of every 6 Americans favoring their big government socialism. 1 out of every 6. Now, Republicans ought to be able to win pretty decisive elections if we go out and we make the case, as Margaret Thatcher used to say, first you win the argument, then you win the vote.
I'm talking to former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who's the author most recently because he's written a lot of great books. His new book is called Beyond Biden, Rebuilding the America We Love. Because, as you said, a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged. I can't imagine today's energy prices as anything but a mugging when the average person pulling up is spending $30 to $40 more for a tank of gas than they did just a year ago. And as you said, this winter is going to be a tough one because we're likely to not only see high prices, but short supply. And we've got a president who literally has not just him, but his spokeswoman saying, well, Americans' gas prices, that's dependent on whether or not the Saudis will pump enough oil for us in a country right. That a year ago was self-sufficient.
Well, and I think the answer is to say to every American, every time they fill up their tank, thank Joe Biden for bankrupting your family. And if you want to keep doing this, if you like this level of pain, vote Democrat. We'll test and see how many masochists there are left in the country.
Well, because this is very, very, very frustrating for the rest of us. And the reason I kind of started with let's go, Brandon, is it seems as though I never thought the Republican Party had the kind of sense of humor that sometimes the other side does. But they seem to have discovered it and said, we've got something we can say. It makes the liberals grind their teeth. And yet it's a great way of shouting your outrage about the president without using a swear word.
Yeah, and you watch. I think you'll presently find that Twitter and Facebook and others are going to decide that let's go, Brandon, is an offensive term, and they'll try to block it because it is so effective. And I really think it's like the Samizdat was in the Soviet era when they had this underground media. That what happened was people wanted a way to ventilate how really deeply they despise what's going on in Washington. And let's go, Brandon, caught on, and I think it's going to keep catching on, and I think it actually means something. I mean, if I were the Democrats and I had, entire stadiums of people chanting, let's go, Brandon, I would be kind of worried that might be a signal of something.
Well, I think they're going to lose in Virginia today, and I think we're going to find out about that tomorrow unless they cheat. But this whole outrage that they watched Donald Trump called every name in the book and people openly wishing for his death and saying really nasty things about him. And now they're all getting, wound up about this, saying it's so offensive. I mean, John Quincy Adams was called a pimp. Andrew Jackson was called worse than Bonaparte. I mean, the original gorilla was what they called Abraham Lincoln. I mean, offensive speech is nothing new in politics, is it, Mr. Speaker?
No, but other than sleepy, I don't know that we've said anything offensive about Joe Biden.
I don't think so either. And the fact that he would tell Americans who really don't want to pay a lot of money, the polls show that too, for any kind of green climate change. But he flies to the other side of the planet with his 85-car entourage to go to a climate summit and then falls asleep during the opening speeches. That's House Speaker Newt Gingrich. His latest book is called Beyond Biden, Rebuilding the America We Love. As I said, he is the happy warrior every day of the week and twice on Sunday. Mr. Speaker, thanks very much for the time. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. If you want to jump in to the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your calls. And of course, naysayers go to the head of the line. If you disagree with my point of view or something I say on the program, I'm glad to get your call. Unlike other shows, it might screen you out. We don't do that. Haven't done it in 25 years, and we're not going to start now. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. It is unbelievable now that America is facing inflation, the likes of which it has not seen in almost one-third of a century. And what do you think is driving all that? Well, I would say the Biden administration and Congress have been driving that. but I thought I'd get an expert opinion from Ryan Young, who's a senior fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Ryan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lars. Yeah, you're not far off the mark there.
Well, okay, so correct me back if I got a little out of my lane. The latest consumer price index for October is a 6.2% increase year over year. And we're looking at the worst inflation we've seen in either 30 or 31 years, depending on whose numbers you believe. Whose numbers should we believe? How bad is it and what's driving it?
Yeah, the last time it was this bad was the recession of 1990-1991. We're still not in stagflation territory, so we're not at Nixon and Carter era. It's not that bad yet, and I don't think it will get that bad. But I do think this is a big cause for concern, especially with Congress about to having just passed the big $1 trillion infrastructure bill with another $2 trillion or so with the reconciliation bill, another $6 trillion budget. And, of course, an election is coming next year, which means we'll be putting a lot of political pressure.
You're breaking up a little bit on me, Ryan. I hope we can get you to a better cell site if you're near a window. Lean toward the window or something. But, Ryan, I'm an old enough guy that I remember stagflation. I was in my early 20s when Jimmy Carter helped to tank the economy, not only with his attitude and his claims that this was a result of American malaise and we should all put on sweaters if we wanted to stay warm and stop thinking about heating our homes, but that stagnation crossed up with inflation. That's what we were in then. What's going to keep us from going there now?
What we have right now is too much money in the economy and too little goods being produced. So one thing we can actually do is stimulate more production by easing up on regulations. For example, about a quarter of all jobs now require some sort of permit or license from the government. Back in the day, it was one job in 20. Now it's one job in 4. That's a bit much. You don't need a license to be a barber or a funeral director or any number of other jobs that require licenses now. Just simply doing that will do a lot to address the 10 million job vacancies that are open right now and get people creating more goods and more services that will get the amount of services back in line with the amount of money that's being pumped into the economy by the Fed.
Let me ask you about a specific law, and we're still breaking up a little bit, but I want people to hear what you're saying, Ryan. How much of this is the result, and I know it's tough to go right down to one specific thing, but California passed, I think it was Assembly Bill 5, that said, you can't be an independent contractor anymore. And people thought of that as the gig economy and Uber and Lyft drivers and folks who, you know, did either legal work or graphics work or computer programming work. But a lot of that involved truck drivers who were independent operators. California, you know, brings in about, I think, 40% of America's cargo through its ports. And now all of a sudden we're short of truck drivers. But is it because California has said you can't drive into California as an independent truck driver and pick up loads and take them where they're headed?
Yeah, California absolutely bears some of the blame. And it's not just truck drivers. There are port restrictions that resist automation and prevent multi-shift workers working around the clock to fill up, declog the ports, basically. So again, you have not enough goods chasing too many dollars. There are two sides of that equation, and policymakers aren't doing the right thing on either side. So we could be in this for a while. It's not going to be the 1970s, but it's not going to be good either.
How much of it could we fix quickly? For instance, I'm not that crazy about Joe Biden and his OSHA mandates and things like that. But if you identify one of the biggest places America gets its cargo is California, and California puts a limit on truck drivers, and you could take that limit off and say, okay, for a period of time at least, California must welcome people who are independent operators, truck drivers, to come in and pick up loads and get them where they're going. Could we clear a lot of that supply chain problem just by, say, the president telling California to put a stop to the independent operator prohibition?
The president doesn't have that kind of authority, but the state government could do that in a snap.
And he could do it with a phone call. He could do as Obama used to brag about, having a pen and a phone. Do you suppose Joe Biden, if he's inclined to go out and start telling people what to do and using, I think, unconstitutional mandates like the OSHA mandate, could he pick up the phone and call Gavin Newsom if Gavin is back from the expensive wedding he went to instead of the climate conference, which I kind of got a kick out of because the guy's an idiot. But if the president called the governor of California and said, hey, this is screwing up the whole country, will you put that thing on pause for 6 months or a year?
Could he? Probably. Will he? I don't think so, because the big constituency it would offend is organized labor, which is one of this party's biggest donors. And there's an election coming up. They need those campaign contributions and those boots on the ground to help the get out the vote operation.
That's Ryan Young, who's a senior fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sorry about the cell phone. Sometimes we run into those problems. But think about this, the easy money. Where do you think the easy money is coming from? I know that many of you got it. I will tell you, I don't have a dog in the fight there. I didn't get a stimulus check. I'm not getting a child care tax credit check. I'm not getting any of those things. So I don't have a bias, but my bias is against the federal government handing out free money when it's not free money. If you haven't sat down and had a conversation with your kids and your grandkids and said, by the way, those checks you're getting, all that free money that gets dropped into your bank account, and you're so glad to see the extra zeros in your bank account, that's going to have to be paid off. Glad to get your calls, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. We'll get to those in the next segment at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarsen.com. It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show, and a pleasure to be with you. And I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. We'll do that in just a bit, but I wanted to talk to my friend Dr. Roger Stark. He's at the Washington Policy Center, about a rather novel idea that might actually take some explaining. And the idea is that providing free health insurance to the poor. So we're not talking about Medicare. That is for older Americans in general. We're talking about Medicaid, and they're very different. That doing this actually puts people in worse shape than if you simply left them to the private marketplace. Now, I understand some of you may say, well, that can't be true. If we're giving them free health insurance, that's got to make things better. Dr. Stark, welcome back to the program.
Great. Thanks for having me on, Lars.
So explain to my audience how this works, that when you offer up Medicaid, and Obamacare dramatically expanded the income definition under which you could get Medicaid by changing the income requirements and all that, so that many more people would be on Medicaid, this actually puts people in worse shape. Why is that?
Well, Medicaid began in 1965 with all good intentions. It was essentially a safety net for low-income families that had children. And what has happened, what's transformed now since 1965, it's become this monolithic, huge entitlement that is forcing taxpayers, both state and federal taxpayers, to support this entitlement. Throughout the course of Medicaid, there have been a number of studies that have showed that specifically that there are no better outcomes, except in very unusual or rare cases, there are no better outcomes with Medicaid than not having insurance at all. One of the hallmark studies was done in Oregon. They looked at about 6,000 or 8,000 people, put them in the Medicaid program. They put another 6,000 to 8,000 people with the same health issues, the same socioeconomic background, and they did not put them in Medicaid. They were essentially uninsured. And after several years, they looked back at the data, and the people that were uninsured basically had no worse health outcomes than the people that were in the Medicaid program. And so it's been documented time and time again that just having Medicaid doesn't provide better health outcomes. Now, people will say, well, yeah, but they have health insurance. Well, sure, but just having health insurance doesn't mean timely access to good care. And that's the real problem, the crux of the problem here with this Medicaid entitlement.
Well, and doctor, isn't some of this about personal responsibility as well? And I've looked at that study that you're talking about. I think it was Harvard that did it. And what happened was Oregon, for a couple of years, didn't have any money to expand Medicaid. So they said, okay, in the meantime, sign up, and when we have some extra money, we'll expand the program. And if you said, well, how do we decide who gets in? They said, we'll have a lottery, and we'll just choose people at random. We're not going to choose younger, healthier people. We're not going to choose older, not-so-healthy people. We're just going to choose at random. And that's how they got the random sample. They got 6,000 or 8,000 people and said, you're in the program. They said to another 6,000 or 8,000, you're not in the program, but you're from the same crowd. You qualify income-wise to get this kind of care. And as you said, they looked at it several years later. The crowd that had the Medicaid card, they spent more money. I think it was almost $1,200 a month more that they spent on health care. But they were spending it not on preventative stuff. They were just, when they got sick enough, they'd go to the emergency room. and it cost tremendous amounts of money, but it didn't necessarily make them healthier because they didn't do what many people might assume you'd do if you had an insurance card in your wallet, is say, I'm going to go see my doctor on a regular basis and spot problems before they become problems. They didn't change their own behavior, just simply having a card in their wallet.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, Lars. And then there was a follow-up study looking at the same groups of people, and what they documented was that the people with that Medicaid card in their pocket, they actually used the emergency rooms much more than the people who were uninsured. So you're absolutely right. The cost was exorbitant for no basic health gain, and it's just been a tragedy.
Well, let's talk about another thing that you wrote about at the Washington Policy Center. How well vaccinated is the group of people on Medicaid? And it even surprised me when I saw you write about what you'd assume, well, if you've got free health care, quote unquote free, meaning somebody else, the taxpayers pay for it, well, then you'd expect that group to be very well protected in terms of vaccination, but they're not.
Yeah, exactly. That study came out a week or two ago, and it was a shock to me as well. I thought, my gosh, these people have free health care. You would think that they would be accessing vaccinations at the same rate that that the rest of the population. But no, they're not. It depends on the locale, the state, so forth, the region. But Medicaid population, their vaccination rate is 30 to 60% less than non-Medicaid patients and non-Medicaid population. So it was shocking to me, and yet we're throwing billions of taxpayer dollars at this Medicaid program, which by virtually every standard is failing the American public, and especially those who really need health care and health insurance. So it's been a real tragedy.
Well, and in fact, in the piece you wrote for Washington Policy Center, to give people an idea, a dollar figure to put with it, in 2019, Medicaid cost two-thirds of $1 trillion. That's what the cost was to the taxpayers, right?
Yeah, and here's the other statistic. In 1970, 5 years after the program began, Medicaid spent, or taxpayers spent about $5 billion. In 2013, taxpayers spent $450 billion. And the last number is 2019, like you said, over $600 billion. And the costs just keep going up and up and up astronomically. And it's unsustainable, Lars. There is no way that the American taxpayer can afford the Medicaid program as it exists today if it's not dramatically reformed.
Well, the other effect, and I want you to comment on this while we've got the time, I've had friends and family members say, well, I was going to take this job that I got offered, but I've decided not to. They don't have a good health insurance plan, or it costs the worker a lot more than my current plan, so they don't go. In this case, if you're giving people quote unquote free health care paid for by somebody else, then it diminishes the effect of any job offer they might get where the job says, hey, we've got this great health plan. You go, I don't care. I'm already getting it free of charge from the government, and your health plan is based on the job, and my free health care from the government is based on the taxpayers. So I'm going to stick with that.
Right. It's a real disincentive to improve your work status. If you make 138% of the federal poverty level or less, you qualify for Medicaid. You make 139% of the federal poverty level, you get kicked out of the Medicaid program. You lose your Medicaid health insurance plan, and it really it's a disincentive, like I say, to try and improve your work status, get a better job, more pay, and so forth. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Dr. Stark, it's a pleasure. That's Dr. Roger Stark with the Washington Policy Center. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to take your phone calls and emails. We'll get back to those in just a moment. But in the meantime, if you want to vote in our Twitter poll, you can find it at Lars Larson Show. If you're not a big fan of Twitter, like I'm not a big fan of Twitter, go to our website at LarsLarson.com. I often get the opportunity, and I consider it a singular opportunity, to be able to talk to people who've served in uniform, and then to be able to talk to a man who's not only served in uniform, but he wants to make sure that some of the stories of those people who have served this country are told in a way so that people can hear what happened. I've told you before, I've not served in uniform. My mom and dad were both in the Navy. My dad was a chief petty officer, and he never really talked about his Navy service. Mom was a Navy nurse, 1940 through 45, the busy years, and she didn't talk about it a lot either. But it wasn't because they were averse to talking about it. It was just not on the agenda. So when I saw the opportunity to talk to Marine Corps Sergeant Andrew Biggio, who's the author of a new book called The Rifle, Combat Stories from America's Last World War II Veterans, told through an M1 Garand, I thought, I've got to get the sergeant on. Sergeant Biggio, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about this.
Well, I'll tell you what, can I ask you to do something that maybe you're not excited to talk about? For my audience, would you tell them about your service in uniform? Because I want them to hear what you did for this country as well.
Sure. In 2006, I enlisted in the Marine Corps. Of course, I think I was in about eighth grade when 9/11 happened. And that will mature you fast, being a 14-year-old kid and walking home from school and seeing the clips of people jumping out of the Twin Towers and buildings on fire, and suddenly you lose interest of playing Pokemon cards and, watching wrestling and whatnot. I didn't think both wars would be going on in 2006. I thought everything would be over by the time I got out of high school, but they weren't. And I enlisted and I served as an infantry rifleman with the Marine Corps in Iraq in 2008 and then Afghanistan in 2011.
Well, thank you very much for that service. I've got to ask you one other thing, because if I don't ask it, my audience will ask me. Was it Paris Island for you, or was it MCRD in San Diego?
I was at Paris Island on 6-6-6, June 6, 2006, and it sure was hell for me. It was my first experience away from home as 18 and dealing with drill instructors who were all combat veterans, and it was interesting.
You know, I'll tell you something. My stepson went through MCRD San Diego, and we got to go down and watch his graduation, and they ran us through a few things. It was fun. Those drill instructors are absolutely unbelievable. I mean, my voice takes a beating. I do about 6 hours of radio a day. These guys and gals, it's unbelievable that they can stand there and shout at a group of recruits, and they do shout just about everything, and they don't lose their voices, and they do it for weeks on end.
Yeah, they work twice as hard as the recruits, because they have to be the exercise with us. They have to be up earlier than us. They get less sleep than us. They have to scream louder than us. And they are a different breed for sure.
They really are. They're fantastic. And I watched them drilling. They were practiced. I mean, these are folks who practiced their drill, their parade drills the night before graduation. And you're thinking, you folks have been doing this for a decade or two each, and yet you still have to practice. But that's it. Spit and polish for the U.S. Marine Corps.
That's for sure.
One of the things I wish that public schools would adopt was when one of those DIs would say, he'd be looking at a group that wasn't necessarily paying attention. And I don't know how it worked at Paris Island, but they'd say eyeballs, and they had to hear you shout click. And then ears open, sir. And if it didn't happen quickly, then they did it again. If they did that in public schools, you think we'd get better educated kids?
You get more discipline, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Marine Corps Sergeant Andrew Biggio is with me. His book is called The Rifle, Combat Stories from America's Last World War II Veterans, told through an M1 Garand. Again, for my audience, I know what a Garand is. I don't happen to own one, but I own a lot of other guns. Would you mind explaining why that gun is so very specifically important to the service of these vets?
Sure. The M1 Garand was the standard rifle almost everybody was issued during World War II. That was the rifle that you ate, slept, and lived with during the duration of the Second World War. And that item is so relatable to veterans of that time, because even if they were in the Air Corps or the Navy, like you said, like your dad, they at least had to fire it, hold it, and shoot it during basic training, right? So General Patton called that the weapon that won the war, because it was the first time our armies had a semi-automatic rifle that could shoot 8 rounds, and you didn't have to keep reloading it or cocking it like the Axis powers had to, like the Germans and the Japanese with their rifles.
And in addition to that, it was a big, heavy gun with big, heavy ammunition. I mean, compare that to the rifle that you were issued when you went through Parris Island.
Yeah, you know, our generation is issued the M16A2 or the M4s. And so it's a lot lighter. And, you know, it's funny because now that they're in their 90s and almost 100 years old, when I hand them the rifle, they refuse to believe it's the same rifle they held 75 years ago. They think it's way too heavy. Every one of them said that.
Well, I'll tell you what, it did win the war. What story do you want to start with in telling some of these stories? And I want to encourage people to get a copy of your book called The Rifle, but where should we start?
Well, it starts with my grandfather's brother being killed in World War II. So he was the first Andrew Biggio. I'm named after him. So when I came home from Iraq and Afghanistan, I had a little bit of survivor's guilt, and especially because I had to drive past Andrew Biggio Memorial Square every day to go to my home. So, you know, it was kind of a sad mind game to see my name up on a memorial sign. And I often thought, you know, what happened to that Andrew Biggio that didn't happen to me in war? How could I better understand this 19-year-old kid's sacrifice? So my grandmother had kept letters he wrote home before he was killed. And in one of the letters, he talked about how much he enjoyed the M1 Grand Rifle and what it was like to shoot it during basic training. So, of course, I run out the door and I go and buy an M1 Grand, a 1945 M1 Grand. And I'm holding it in my house, and I'm like, okay, well, now what? You know, this is great. I have it. I'm trying to feel what he felt, understand what he went through. And then I said, why don't I take it to my neighbor? He was in the Battle of Okinawa. So the first gentleman I'll tell you about is Joe Drago with the 6th Marine Division on Okinawa. So I ring his doorbell, and Joe is very weak and, you know, frail. He's about 92 at this time. And I said, hey, Joe, you remember this? And I put the rifle into his hands. And he's, you know, bound to a recliner. He can't walk too well anymore. And he just transformed back into that 19-year-old kid again. He puts the rifle in his shoulder. Okay, that heavy rifle. Puts it in his shoulder, starts aiming in, waving it around. I have to literally duck out of the way because the rifle just swings right by my face. And he starts telling me about the April 1st, 1945, going into Okinawa, being the first wave of troops in the Battle of Okinawa, the last major operation of World War II. And I sit there for hours, and I just start recording him with this rifle. And this ends up being chapter one of my book. And I said, you know, Joe, I always want to remember this moment. Sign my rifle. And he didn't want to sign it. He's like, it's such a beautiful weapon. Why would you want me to ruin it? I'm like, just sign your name to the wooden stock.
The stories are told in The Rifle, Combat Stories from America's Last World War II Veterans. We'll be back in just a moment with Marine Corps Sergeant Andrew Biggio. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I will get back to your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you send emails, they all do come to me. They don't go to an intern or a producer. That's talk@LarsLarson.com, and I encourage you to visit our website. Everything there is free except the challenge coins, and the sale of those goes to benefit a veterans group, not to yours truly. I'm with Marine Corps Sergeant Andrew Biggio, who's the author of a new book called The Rifle, Combat Stories from America's Last World War II Veterans, told through an M1 Garand. You talked about your grandfather. Was it tough to read those letters that he wrote, knowing that he was writing them literally in the last days of his life, but he didn't know it?
You know, it's weird. It was very hard, but he started to know it. It's so sad to read a 19-year-old kid writing home to his mom, begging her to mail a gold cross, a gold chain, to Italy. Can you, you know, one of his last letters, hey, Mom, can you send that gold cross to wear around my neck? And then his last letter was, I really don't want to go back up this hill, because they were trying to take some hill. It's almost like he knew, you know. I get emotional just thinking about this kid. And that's what, you know, Memorial Day this weekend is about. And that a lot of us don't know about these 18 and 19-year-old kids who are still buried over there in Italy, buried in Belgium, buried in Luxembourg, buried in France. Their names we'll never know, and Andy Biggio was one of them. And I'm just so proud to have carried on this kid's legacy 75 years later by interviewing those who had survived to write this novel about World War II.
Well, we'll give my audience just a taste of this so that they can make sure to go out and get a copy of the book and read the stories for themselves. Does it disappoint you as somebody who has served in uniform that this country seems to have fallen away from its usual tradition, I think, for hundreds of years, of really setting aside honors for the people who've served in uniform? Because it used to be that almost everybody had a family member or a close friend who had served, and these days, I remind people that out of 330 million people, there are about 9% who are either serving now or have served, which means there are people out there who don't know a single person who's ever served in uniform. This may be one of the first times in history that Americans have been in that situation where you just don't know anybody who's ever done it, and you don't know anybody who's ever lost somebody who served in uniform.
Yeah, you know, I would hate to see another world war unite us, okay, because that's not what it should come down to. And I think that's where we're failing on educating and remembering what had happened only 75 years ago, okay, or excuse me, 77 years ago. I think this June will be 77 years that our troops landed in France, but, you know, the wars were going on. It didn't end until 45, so... Yeah, it shouldn't take another terrorist attack or another war to unite us as Americans. We need to be pumping to our kids the sacrifices and what had taken place and what these young 18, 19, 20-year-old men and women did in order to defeat real evil and real Nazism. And it's, I don't know, we've slipped. We've definitely slipped. I'm a 1987 kid. I grew up in the 90s. I remember the World War II veterans still selling poppies on the corner, and I got to see the parades. And now the World War II generation's almost gone, sadly. And they represented, there was 16 million World War II veterans, 16 million. Now there's the VA says there might be 300,000, and that's not even including who's ambulatory to even go out and be in parades and participate and educate the general public anymore. So we've dwindled down. There's that years between World War II and Vietnam, and then of course the 40-year gap between Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan.
Who is the next person that you talk to after that first interview, which you I think brilliantly touched off by handing an M1 Garand to a vet? Who'd you talk to next?
Well, I looked down at the rifle and I said, wow, that was a little taste of the Pacific. Let me get someone who fought in the European theater. And my own grandfather was wounded in the Battle of the Bulge, but had died before I got to even come up with this rifle idea. So I said, I want to meet a Battle of the Bulge veteran. And the second person I went to was Ernie Roberts of the 87th Infantry Division. He's still alive. He's 96. And he earned the Silver Star in World War II. He was a machine gunner with the 87th Infantry Division. He was a 18, 19-year-old kid during the Battle of the Bulge, freezing. A little bit about his story. As a machine gunner, he would usually set up his tripod in the windows of different barns or homes, Belgian homes, during the battle. And there was this one time where, you know, he went out to go look for some milk. They went to go milk some cows in order to get something to drink, scavenge some houses for food. And he comes back, and all that's sitting in the window of the house is the tripod.
Oh, no.
His squad is gone. The machine gun's gone. And he looks out the window, and there's a German tank pointing at the house. And obviously, the squad bailed on him while he was out looking for food. And the tank fires one shell. It goes right through the house. It did not explode, because if it did, it would kill them. But it sent splinters and plaster and wood into his face. And he grabs the tripod, jumps out the second-story window, and he's running with the tripod in his back, and he could feel rounds ricocheting off the tripod that he's carrying on his back. And he makes it to his own lines again, but he's covered in, like, dirt and blood and soot that they think he's a German, and they ask him for the password, and he doesn't know it. You know, after being blown up by a tank, practically. And that's just a little taste of his story. He goes on to fight, cross the Rhine River, and then go into Germany. And, you know, ultimately earns the Silver Star for taking out a German pillbox on the Siegfried Line.
So
he's the author of The Rifle, Combat Stories from America's Last World War II Veterans, told through an M1 Garand. Let me ask you about that, because in my time as a reporter, I mean, 40 years ago, it would have been really routine for me to run into police officers. And as I found out more about them, because I got to know a lot of cops pretty well as a reporter, many of them had military backgrounds. In fact, you almost were better off to assume that somebody who was a cop had been in the military. These days, that's not as true as it used to be. Or have you found it otherwise?
It depends on the department. I started off with a department that was a ton of veterans. Almost everybody was, because we had veteran preference and it was cool. Then I transferred to a smaller town where that's not the case, and I am like one of two guys on the department that are veterans. So it's not the case for every department, but there sure is there's still an abundant amount of people who went from military into law enforcement, and we are so grateful to have those guys serving with the badge, because I think a lot of those guys went into the military. They were able to mature. They were able to blow off any, steam in the younger ages in order to learn a lot about different cultures and people and backgrounds and experience, of course, and discipline before going into the military. What they did was they disguised it better. The media and the government, of course, did not want to admit these veterans had problems. Which they did. I also interviewed a ton of World War II veterans who became cops themselves and would get calls of other veterans having issues. The government didn't want to admit that some guys came home with issues, and it was frowned upon for any of the media to talk about it or acknowledge it.
The stories are told in The Rifle, Combat Stories from America's Last World War II Veterans, told through an M1 Garand. Its author is now police officer, but former Marine Corps Sergeant Andrew Biggio. If I can talk to Sergeant Biggio into one more segment, we'll be back in a moment to tell a few more stories. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and a real pleasure to have with me Marine Corps, retired now, but Marine Corps Sergeant Andrew Biggio, who's the author of The Rifle, Combat Stories from America's Last World War II Veterans, told through an M1 Garand. In this last segment, can we tell just a few more of the stories of the 200 that you spoke to put this book together, Sergeant?
Yes. I'm on the way now to deliver one of the advanced copies to one of my heroes in the book. His name is Robert Andrew, and he served with the 761st Tank Battalion, which was an all-black tank outfit during World War II. They were the first African-American tank unit to see combat in France and then the Battle of the Bulge. And Robert was the gunner of a Sherman tank when he was wounded by a German bazooka. A bazooka had penetrated the tank outside the town of Nancy, France, and severely wounded the driver. The driver lost an eye, and Robert had shrapnel in his arm and his legs. And he had to come home as a black man in the 1940s and deal with not only racism, but also post-traumatic stress and recovering from his wounds. This guy is a guy who does not feel sorry for himself. He is an absolute inspiration. He came home, have five children, had a long, successful career. He's now about 96 years old, and I'm going to give him a copy of his book. And I can't wait to share his story with the world.
Sergeant, you mentioned that this is his book, and really that's what it is. You've made this the book that really belongs to the people who told the story.
That's right. There's, of the 200 men that signed The Rifle, I picked about 20 of the best stories to make a whole book out of, a first book. This book is dedicated to them. It's their book. He has his own chapter, and I'm going to personally deliver him his copy of the book. He deserves it for everything he went through. I'm hoping to get him back to go back to France with me in a few months.
Wow.
When things calm down, to show him where he's going.
Sergeant, you faded out on me for a moment. I think maybe your cell phone had a little bit of a glitch. Are you still there for me?
Yep. I'm looking forward to hopefully convince him to come back to France with me in a few months when it's safe to do so with COVID precautions, to show him where he was wounded.
Did they ever ask you about what you did? I mean, you went to both theaters, to both Afghanistan and Iraq.
You know, they do, and they think it's so odd that we had an enemy that didn't wear uniforms.
Now, hold on a second. You faded out, and I want people to hear everything you said. Sergeant Biggio, you said they ask you, and they find it odd that what?
They find it, you know, when they ask me about my own service, they can't fathom fighting an enemy that didn't wear uniforms. So they find that so odd that how do you win a war with an enemy that doesn't wear uniforms? And they're, of course, referring to the Taliban or the Iraq insurgency because it just boggles their mind. You know, in World War II, they had front lines. They had a uniformed enemy. When they took ground, they owned it. And that's just not the case with the modern wars. So they think my situation is complex, but yet, obviously, I think storming Omaha Beach is complex.
Yeah, because in your case, you were fighting in a very asymmetric war, weren't you?
Yes. Yep. And they, you know, they were able to take ground and continue to conquer and liberate villages. And, you know, they had Geneva Convention and surrendering. And that's just not what we have in the post 9/11 world.
And they came home to at least, I know you talked about the black service member, but they came home to a hero's welcome for the most part, whereas Iraq and Afghanistan continue to be controversial engagements. I mean, I will admit, Sergeant, that I said I thought that answering the attack on 9/11 by going to Afghanistan was absolutely essential. Staying for a record length of time, if there are bad guys on the planet, do you let them continue to be bad guys until they reach a certain level, or do you try to deal with them when you can't?
Right. Those are all legitimate statements. Those are legitimate thoughts I have. But, you know, it's like for us, after 9/11, we rose our hand to serve. I think a lot of us didn't care what the cause or where we were going to send it. We wanted to serve. The World War II generation were our heroes, and we wanted to be just like them. The soldier doesn't get to pick the war, unfortunately. He just does what he's told. And I think there's so much. The World War II generation were just extraordinary men thrown in such an extraordinary time who were able to do extraordinary things. And I think that generation of kids, 9/11, were thinking the same thing, that they also wanted to do what was right. And unfortunately, we get caught up in politics. But I think the heart and soul of the American soldier is no different in 75 years.
Sergeant Andrew Biggio is my guest. We have time. His book is called The Rifle, Combat Stories from America's Last World War II Veterans, told through an M1 Garand. Sergeant, I think we've got time for you. Would you share one more of the veteran stories and maybe even one that you didn't choose? And that must have been tough to choose out of 200 stories.
Oh, yeah.
To choose 25. Mm-hmm. Would you mind?
Yeah. Yeah. I think another gentleman I could talk to you about is, his name is Clarence Cormier. And Clarence was a brand new soldier, not even in Europe 2 weeks, when half the division comes up with the solution to surrender to the Germans.
Sergeant, it is a real pleasure. Again, thank you for your service. And thanks for the service you do now, because I also back the blue.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that.
Take care now. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.